All right, so we are examining the question of the premillennial doctrine. And last week, I won't go back through it all, but I've given several handouts, and I'll refer back to these from time to time. But we kind of dealt with an introduction to what these doctrines teach. And what I want to do starting tonight is beginning to look at each of these issues individually against the Bible, looking at what does the Word of God actually say in regard to the rapture, premillennialist doctrine, and dispensationalism, those kind of things. Moving forward. So we're dealing with a few questions. I have a lot up here. But we as I mentioned, we looked last week at the doctrines that are involved. And then we're asking the question, so will there be signs of the coming of Jesus? Many have claimed to know when he's coming back or been able or tried or attempted to predict a date. Was that even possible? Can we know when he's coming back? Are there signs that we can look for? Will there be a rapture? Is that doctrine taught within Scripture as we look deeper at it? Will there be a great tribulation as taught in premillennialism? Is that something that we see within Scripture? Who is the son of perdition as he's been labeled the Antichrist? Who is John referring to? In his writings, as well as Paul in his letter to the Thessalonians. Will there be a thousand-year reign of Christ on earth? Is that taught within Scripture? Is that something we should look forward to? What will actually occur at the end of time? What does the Bible lay out? What do we know of heaven and hell? And finally, how do I get myself prepared for the second coming and final judgment? That a lot of topics. Of course, we won't be able to get to all that this evening, but we're going to continue on and traverse through these things. So, as we've mentioned before, are we near the end of time? Can we know if we are near the end of time? Are there things we should be looking for? Will there be signs of his coming? Well, what does the Bible say about this? Let's go to Matthew 24. And this is one I've kind of hit already in one of my sermons, but I don't want to short you here because not everybody heard that. But we're going to look at some of what we looked at in that lesson. So Matthew 24 is the place, a good place for us to start. Matthew 24. I want to go ahead and read a little bit there at the beginning just to give us context of where we are. The text says in verse 1 that Jesus left the temple and was going away when his disciples came to point out to him the buildings of the temple. Now verse 1 gives us where we are. We're in Jerusalem. We're near the temple. We're within sight of it. Jesus has just exited. Now, the temple we're looking at is the temple of Herod. It was in the midst of being remodeled at the time. This was a long process. It took many years for this to occur. They would eventually finish the remodeling of this temple in about 58 A.D. 68 AD, and we know what happened in AD 70. It was actually destroyed. So this temple that he's looking at only had about 2 years of actual completion before Rome destroyed it. Just keep that in mind. So they're coming out of the temple and looking back at it, and the text tells us that the disciples are kind of wanting to brag about it or talk about its beauty or whatever. And so they're pointing it out to Jesus and saying certain things. Notice his response in verse number 2. But he answered them, "You see all of these things, do you not?" Now that's the temple and all the things around it. Truly I say to you, there will not be left here one stone upon another that will not be thrown down. So I'm sure at that moment the disciples were probably pretty shocked that he would say such a thing. Now, it's not that shocking, the temple being destroyed, because we've already seen it a few times in the past. And Jesus saying it's going to happen again. So that's real important. That is the premise on which the disciples asked their next couple of questions. So we're all there. So he just said the temple will be destroyed, not one stone left upon another. And then in verse 3, what is their response? And this sets the whole context of what's going to come afterwards. As he sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately, saying, "Tell us when these things be, and what will be the sign of your coming and the end of the age." Now, do you notice something right there? Number one, how many questions do they ask?
Two.
You could say three questions. Now, that's important. They're asking more questions than they realize they're asking. You notice the connection they made, either knowingly or unknowingly, what was the connection they made with the temple and the end of time? They're going to be at the same time. That's what they think. Real important we realize that. That their understanding at the moment is, well, if the temple's going to be destroyed, that must be the end of time. So they ask, when will these things be? That's the temple destruction. That's referring back to the previous verse. And then they ask, okay, so when will the end of time be and what will be the signs? Just important that we realize that. And then we'll get into his response. All right, so verse number 4. So they've asked these questions. Jesus said, or answered them, "See that no one leads you astray." I want to point that out because he's acknowledging what? There are going to be some who come along and teach false doctrines about these things. "See that you are not led astray." So he's warning them against false doctrines being taught. He goes on to say, "For many will come in my name, saying, 'I am the Christ,' and they will lead many astray. And you will hear of wars and rumors of war. See that you are not alarmed." Get that? You're going to hear about these things. Don't be alarmed. In other words, what's he saying? Those are not the sign of the end of times. For this must take place, but the end is not yet. For nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom. There will be famines and earthquakes in various places. All these things are but the beginning of the birth pains. Now, you may be like me, and you've heard from time to time people talk about, oh, listen to all these things going on. There's wars and rumors of wars. We must be near the end of time. Well, did you catch what Jesus just said? That's just going to go on. Kingdoms have been at war since the beginning of time. People have been at war. In other words, what he's saying is that's not a sign of the end of time. Don't look for those things, because that's just man and what he does. All right, so so number one, he starts by acknowledging that there are those who are going to teach false things, and he doesn't want them to get taken away by listening to those things. But that doesn't really answer our question. All right, so let's go down to verse 44. Matthew 24, 42. All right, we're going to come back and catch some of these other things, but I just want to note in connection with this question what he says. So if you go down to verse 42... he goes on to say, "Therefore, stay awake, for you do not," notice this, "for you do not know on what day your Lord is coming." You might want to underline that. You do not know what? When the Lord is coming. But know this. Okay, you can't know when he's coming, but you can know this. That if the master of the house had known in what part of the night the thief was coming, he would have stayed awake and not let his house have been broken into. Therefore, you also must be ready, for the Son of Man is coming, what? At an hour you do not expect. In other words, are there going to be signs of his coming? Wouldn't that be knowledge? He says, but you can't know. You're not going to know when he's coming back. So there are not going to be signs of his coming. He gives us this example of a thief. I have the parable of the weeds. I'm going to come back to that, so hold off on that for right now. Go to 1 Thessalonians 5. 1 Thessalonians 5. Paul is going to give us a similar answer to this question. 1 Thessalonians 5 and verse 1. Somebody read 1 through 3. Give my voice a break for a minute. Somebody read that. 1 Thessalonians 5, 1 through 3.
For the times and of the seasons, brethren, you have no need that are right in you, for yourselves know perfectly that the day of the Lord shall come as a thief in the night. For when thou shalt say peace and safety, then sudden destruction come upon you, as travail upon a woman with child, and they shall not escape.
He says, verse 2, for you yourselves know, right? For yourselves are fully aware that the day of the Lord will come like what? A thief. Does a thief call you ahead of time to let you know he's coming? Does he send up a flare when he's near the house? He finds a time when you're not home most of the time, and he wants to come while you're gone because he doesn't want you to know. Well, he says in a similar way, when Jesus comes back, he's coming at a time that you are just simply not going to know. And so, are there going to be signs of his coming? No, there's just not going to be. If you go to the parable of the weeds, and we're not going to go verse by verse through this. I'm going to paraphrase it, but I have those references for you to go back and look at. But here is a series of parables that Jesus is giving, implying the need to be prepared. And so he gives a couple different ones. He gives the parable of the weeds here, which is, he compares the kingdom of heaven to a man who's planted a field, right? And he's planted his wheat out there, and he's tending it, and it's growing up, but unfortunately, an enemy has come in and planted weeds in amongst his wheat. And his servants ask, well, do you want us to go and pull up the weeds? And what's the answer? No, don't do that, because if you do it, you might pull up some of the wheat, and I don't want you to do that. And so in verse number 30, what's his response? What's that? Wait till the harvest. He says, let them both grow until the harvest. All right? So what does all this really mean? Well, Jesus answers many of our questions later on in verse 36 and following. He tells us kind of what this parable is all about. He tells us that they ask for an explanation, the disciples do, in verse 36. Verse 37, he says, the one who sows the good seed is the Son of Man. That's him, right? That's the Son of God. The field is the world, right? It's our known world. The good seed is the sons of God. That's the wheat, right, that's produced. The tares are the sons of the evil one. So it's the church and the world, right? Those who are wicked, those who are Christ. And he says they're growing up together, right? He's already told us that they're both going to grow up until the harvest time. He then goes on to say in verse 39, the enemy is the devil. That's the one who's planted these wicked seeds in amongst the good. And the harvest is what? the end of the age. And so, in other words, what he's saying to us is this process of the wheat and the tares is going to continue both growing together until the end of time. And that's going to be important when we come back to this and refer to it a few times. But I just want to get that concept. Jesus saying there's not going to be these periods of time when certain ones are going to be taken away and others are left. But they're going to grow together until the end. And at the end, what happens? The harvest. What's the harvest? That's Judgment Day. All right. So, will there be signs of the second coming? The Bible's pretty clear about it. No, it's like a thief in the night. There's not going to be signs for us to look for. So, can we know when the coming's going to be? And this answers itself pretty easily, what we just talked about. Yes, sir.
Question.
Uh-huh.
So, Jesus talks about all these things that have to come to pass, and yeah, he says no man knows the day or the hour, but he tells you to be awake and watch, because there's going to be signs of his coming, and then he gives the parable of the fig tree in 24:32, where it says, now learn the parable of the fig tree, when its branch is yet tender and put forth leaves, you know that summer is near. So, I mean, in my mind, just because we don't know the hour or the day, doesn't mean that we can't
do it. So
time frame, if we're not paying attention.
So the signs that you're talking about, can you tell me what signs are you looking at there?
All right.
What verses are you looking at?
So one, the earthquakes, the rumors of war, and it's not just Matthew 24. It's also when you consider Revelations and some of the other prophets.
Okay. So let's just deal with Matthew 24 now. I'm going to come back to the book of Revelation a little bit, probably next week or so. But let's just deal with Matthew 24 first. So, again, I want to go back. I was going to come back to this, but let's go ahead and jump back to Matthew 24. This is real important that we understand the context of Matthew 24. Remember what I said? He's really asking two questions, or three. You could even say three. But really two of them connected. One of them is not connected. They think it is, but it's not. And that is the abomination of desolation. That's the one with the signs. This is real important. So let's go back there for just a second. All right, good question, Aaron. I want to answer this. So let's go. So they've asked two questions. And let's go to verse number 9. I don't want to have to read this whole thing, but we need to read some of it. So, verse 9, he says, then they will deliver you, who's the you there?
Saints.
But specifically, who's he talking to?
The apostles.
The apostles, right? The early church. Now, this is important because you saints, we're saints, right?
Yeah.
We need to be specific here. He says, you will be delivered up to tribulation and put to death. And you will be hated by all nations for my name's sake. I don't know about you, but I've never been afraid of going to jail. But they did. And many of them were. Historically, all but one of the apostles died by being killed for their faith. All but one, John. And he lived out a majority of the end of his life in prison. So he says, you will be delivered up to tribulation and put to death. And then many will fall away and betray one another. So when persecution happens, and like again, we could get way in depth about this. When did the persecution of the church begin? Anybody tell me when that occurred? Acts chapter 8. Well, really, Acts 7. With the stoning of Stephen, what happens in Acts 8? They scatter out, and then the persecution continues, and there from there on, the church is persecuted in various ways. First by the Jews, later by the Romans. So the church is going to suffer severe persecution. Go to the book of Revelation. They're writing to the seven churches, I want you to go back and note how many of them he talks about persecutions coming against them. Several, even at that moment when John is writing, like the church in Philadelphia, is under heavy persecution. The Ephesian church is in the city of the temple of Diana. Do you remember in the book of Acts what happens at Diana's temple? Paul comes through preaching the truth, and many people quit following Diana, and then the people who make the little Diana dolls get upset and eventually lead to Paul stoning Lystra. Is it Lystra or Iconium? One of those two. He's stoned nearly to death because, and it all goes back to what happened at the Temple of Diana. So the church begins to suffer. Remember, you will begin to suffer tribulation. Go back to the text here. So there will be a persecution, and then what will happen? Many will fall away and betray one another and hate one another. So it's going to do some damage to the church. Those who are less faithful are going to be harmed. And many false prophets will arise and lead many astray. I think about Galatians chapter 1, 6 through 9. What does Paul say? I marvel that you are so quickly turning aside to another gospel, which really isn't another gospel. All right, he says, let him be accursed if they preach anything different than they had received. As early as the Galatian letter, already false doctrines are being taught. So he says persecution will bring people leaving the gospel. Others will begin teaching false gospels. Verse 12, and because lawlessness will be increased, the love of many will grow cold. But the one who endures to the end will be saved. And this is the gospel of the kingdom will be proclaimed throughout the whole world as a testimony to all the nations. And then the end will come. So he says persecution is going to come. There's going to be a falling away. There's going to be false doctrines taught. But the gospel is going to continue to be taught. And he says to all the world. And then eventually what's going to happen? The end is going to come. But he doesn't tell us when. All right, so go to verse 15. So, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by the prophet Daniel. So Daniel speaks about this in some visions he's seen. We'll talk more about that later. I had that later, but let's go ahead. We'll deal with this and then I'll go back to Daniel later. Standing in the holy place, let the reader understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Now let me ask you a question. If this was referring to the end of time, why would you flee to the mountains? What good is that going to do you? And if you're a Christian, why would you flee? You wouldn't, right? But he says flee to the mountains. Why do you flee to the mountains? What's in the mountains?
Cover, safety.
Cover, safety, right? There's somewhere to get out of this. So in other words, the abomination of desolation has to do with a local problem or a local happening, right? It's somewhere you can get out of. When the flood came, was there anywhere for Noah and his family to go? They just needed to build a boat so they could. That was their only escape. They couldn't go over some other land to escape the flood. Well, this is a situation you can escape. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let the one who is on the housetop not go down to take what is in his house. So this is something you need to do quickly. When you see this happening, do this quickly. And let the one who is in the field not turn back to take his cloak. And alas, for women who are pregnant and for those who are nursing infants in those days. He's saying a woe to those who would be in that situation because the immediate need to get away is going to be very urgent. And so if you're having, dealing with a child and everything, it's going to slow you down. So it's like, woe to those. Like, you're going to have to be ready to go. Pray that your flight may not be in winter or on a Sabbath, for then there will be great tribulation. Such as has not been from the beginning, of the world until now and never will be. And if those days have not been, if those days had not been cut short, no human being would be saved. But for the sake of the elect, that's the church, those days will be cut short. Then if anyone says to you, look, here is the Christ, or there is the Christ, what? Don't believe them. So when this happens, what are people going to say? Oh, this must be the Christ. He's coming. He says, don't do that. This isn't the coming of Christ. What's he doing? He's answering the first question about the temple. He's talking about the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem. When did that occur? AD 70, when Rome came in and destroyed the temple, when not one stone was left on another. And so as you continue through the text there, he just continues talking about this. That's what continues until you get to verse number 39. I'm sorry, verse 36. So when you're talking about signs, those are the signs he gives. We'll get more into 36 later, but 36 is an answer to those second two questions, which is what? End of time, his second coming and end of time. And we're going to deal with those directly. But those signs you see in 15 and following are dealing with that first question, the abomination of desolation, not with the end of time. So I would say those signs, there's no signs given there for the end of time. We'll come back, like I said, for the other one. But I will point out, just so we say it, if you go down to verse 36, he says, but concerning that day and hour, no one knows what? Not even the angels of heaven, nor the Son, but the Father only. For as were the days of Noah, so will it be of the coming of man. For as in those days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage until the day when Noah entered the ark. And they were unaware until the flood came and swept them all away. So will be this coming of the Son of Man. So there's no signs mentioned. He says, actually, you can't know. And this goes into our next question. I've kind of already hit this. But there's not going to be signs of his second coming. There's nothing for us to look forward to. And so the imperative need is what? Be ready all the time. Because there isn't going to be, okay, oh, wait, there he's getting ready to come. Let me go get ready. It's going to come like a thief in the night. And it's interesting that even Jesus himself confesses that it wasn't information even he had. It wasn't knowledge that had been given to him. But in verse 43, again, he compares it to a thief in the night, that he will come like that. And there's two other references to this that I mentioned in the sermon. 2 Peter 3:10, 1 Thessalonians 5:1-4. Both Peter and Paul both say the coming, the second coming, will be like what? Like a thief. And it'll come at a time we don't realize. So again, can we know? The truth is, Jesus didn't even know. We're claiming to have knowledge he didn't have. And I think that's very, very scary. For us to ever claim we know something he did not know. So, can we know? No, we can't. Questions about that? Yes, ma'am.
One thing we can know, and you can read about it, I just looked it up to see if it was obvious, and it's, you'd have to dig, but there are secular historians, Josephus, and some of them who wrote about, not Christian history, but the world history in the first and second century, and they wrote about this. The fall of Jerusalem and all that, they're, when it talks about, you know, one person will be taken, one person will, you know, gone from the fields, that's when they ran. I mean, the Christians, actually, the warnings, they ran away because they were warned and they left, and there's, I have read where, Turner, you and Charlene may remember, we did a long study on this one time about the, in a model class, and it said that the historians had said that there were no Christians killed when the Jerusalem fell, because they had all left. They had left because they had been warned through the scriptures to leave. They were able to do that.
And what's fascinating is they were given signs to watch for that. But that again goes to that first question of the abomination of desolation, which is what his first answer is related to, is that temple, and they were told to leave. And so thankfully for most they did, right, and they ran out. And so, yes, if you go back and you study that, it was brutal what the Romans did to
them. For history, the Romans surrounded Jerusalem, mm-hmm. and if they had attacked that at that point, they would have destroyed them all. Mm-hmm. But the commander of the Roman group got sick or got replaced or whatever. For 3 days, they withdrew, which gave the Christians opportunity to leave, or anyone else that actually believed Jesus.
And I think it's interesting, too, in that whole abomination of the destruction of the temple, is he tells us that for the Christian's sake, for the elect's sake, what? It had been cut short. So God shortened what was going to happen there because of the church.
Well, as Gentiles, 2,000 years later, I mean, we don't have a clue, but we think it is. It's confusing for us. But can you imagine how confusing it was to these people? But the Jewish Christians, their whole lifestyle, I mean, their whole world was being destroyed. I mean, the whole Judaism, the temple and the worship and the priest and all that history and keeping up with who your daddy was and all that stuff has gone away. And it was an end of their age.
So in answering the can we know? No, we can't. So again, it implies that need to always be ready. Will it come in our lifetime? I have no idea. And we've been waiting for 2,000 years, and we still have no idea. Will it be another 2,000 years? Will it be tomorrow? Only God knows that, and he's not given us any forewarning of when that will occur. Yes, sir.
I think Ms. Lynn may be referring to Josephus' writings. You know, Titus pulled back for a period of time and allowed them to escape. But you know, you look at it, the big picture, some of the things, why would a woman, if it was a second coming, that with child, why would that be a concern?
Well, yeah.
Second coming, or why would you want to go get your coat if that was a second coming? I mean, a lot of those things, they fit the physical world, but not the spiritual.
Yeah. Because if it was a second coming for a Christian, that's a day to rejoice. Right.
Right.
You'd be excited about it. You wouldn't want to be running in terror of that. For us, that's going to be a day of rejoicing.
I'm not the youngest person here, but I'm not the oldest either. But for as long as I can remember, I remember time, people telling me that this is the end of time. We're in that time. Yeah. That I, you know, for 30 years, I can remember. Well, there's always somebody saying, yeah. This
I always
is
say,
I feel like that's been going on.
Yeah.
For all of time.
And I always say to that person is, well, then you're claiming to have information Jesus.
That's exactly
have, and
yeah.
I would be very scared.
Like, how many, I mean, I know 10 people that have been wrong.
That's just the first bell, right? Oh, you can cut me off 5 minutes here.
What did you say, brother?
Well, I just say that there's always somebody that wants to claim that they have that knowledge. Or they
and we've seen it over and over again. I mean, I don't have those up here, but like, there was a guy who said it was 1980, and there was times before that, and he adjusted, it was like 1988, right? And he kept moving it forward. Now I saw there's a new one. It's sometime near in the future, 28 maybe, or they're predicting another time. So those things continue to be, but again, they're claiming to have knowledge that Jesus did not have. And so I would be very sketchy of anybody to claim that. So, can we know? No. All right, so let's move into this next thing. We won't be able to finish it, but I do want to talk about the rapture. Now, this is another one that we've heard from time to time. And there's a difference we need to know between the term itself and the doctrine behind it. So those are two different things that we need to think about. I just want to share with you a little bit from Defending the Faith study Bible notes you can look at. But the term rapture comes from a Latin word, which means to seize, snatch, or to seize, to snatch out, or take away. That's the literal definition of the word. I'll let him go on by here for a second. What you also notice is that term is not in the Bible anywhere. So the term rapture, if you go ahead and look it up, I think we did this in something we were talking about, that term is not there. But is the concept there? Is the doctrine there? Certain groups apply this word to the idea that Christ will come suddenly and secretly. This is important. Suddenly and secretly. Now, if you go back and look at the diagram I gave you, this one right here, I didn't put it up on our stuff today. I should have done that. But according to the premillennialist doctrine, they believe that will come at the end of the church age right here. And it will be a sudden and secret taking up, snatching away of the faithful and being carried up to heaven to await a 7-year period of tribulation. And we'll talk about the Great Tribulation in a little bit. And we'll ask the question, is that biblical? But just the rapture itself is the idea that he will come suddenly and secretly in the air to snatch away from earth the living saints and the resurrected bodies of those who have died. This rapture is supposed to occur just prior to the 7-year tribulation, in which in turn will be followed by the millennium. Proponents claim that the rapture will be secretive. We're told that families will be shocked by the strange disappearance of a mother, a father, or child. Driverless cars will collide in the streets. Thus, you may see the sticker, the bumper sticker, in case of rapture, this vehicle will be unmanned. A man and wife will be in bed. She hears a noise, turns her head, and finds him gone. Planes will crash with no pilots found. These sensational, dramatic examples illustrate the view that the rapture will be an invisible coming of the Lord for his saints, leaving visible results of chaos and confusion among the remaining unbelievers. All right, so let's talk about this idea. Now, again, there's a separate the term from the doctrine. Is rapture biblical? Now, I want to start in Matthew 24, and then we're going to look at some other texts. But Matthew 24, again, remember what's going on. Jesus is answering a couple questions. The first one he answers about the temple and the destruction of the temple. And then he goes on to answer the question about the end of time and the signs of his second coming. If you go down, I won't go back through all that again. Put that in the wrong place. All right. Let's go down to verse 36. Verse 36, he begins to answer that second question. Oh, it can't be ringing. All right. I'm sorry. We'll stop right there. You want to go back and look at Matthew 26 or 24 again? That would be good. We'll talk about where the doctrine comes from, and then how does the Bible speak about it? Is it true or not? And then we'll move on to answer some of these other questions. Any comments or questions before we end? Thank you for your good comments and questions today. We'll continue studying, looking at this, and some other things as well. We'll be dismissed now and rejoin for our devotion in just a moment.